This is the second side of the seventh session, June 3rd, 2004, 2006. So the images, just continuing here, the images of the statement, the ego ideal and the notion of inner self in quotes, are instead united in a single quality. LaRouche said that, and the Buddhist could agree with those words, but the images of the consequences and the application of that sentence probably are pretty different between LaRouche and the Dalai Lama or the Buddhist, because LaRouche says, he says this leads to a negentropic synthesis and that the creative process becomes regarded as a virtue. Now, Buddhists might think the creative process is the mind, and that's just mind chatter. They seem to be wanting to move into a state of bliss or detachment or coolness or aplomb or relaxed state that is...
Well, they want to respond to the matrix in which they live. I know that when China was invading Tibet, now up to that point in time, they'd lived a kind of tribal existence where artistic expression was very important. They wove tapestries, they made the tankas, they created architecture, they created a beautiful environment to live in, and they had a spiritual philosophy that had taken hundreds of years to develop, including...
Though there's many other views of that. It was a feudal, brutal environment. But
right. Well, I'm going to...
What you're saying,
I'm telling you my idealistic view.
Yeah.
They developed... meditation was central, and gave them a sense of blissful communion with the cosmos, which probably relieves the boredom of living in a on a high mountaintop with nothing else to do. But when China was invading Tibet, at that point the Dalai Lama was, you know, he was very interested in adopting technology, because he saw that that's what was happening next, and that that they needed to get on the bandwagon. So there was a flexibility and a willingness but they didn't have the ability to develop scientific geniuses in the way that LaRouche thinks about it.
Yeah, they didn't even know that McLuhan predicted that China would explode in a nationalistic exclusive energy pattern as a result of the television and them reacting, the television environment.
Yeah, China wanted to industrialize. They didn't want to be left behind.
They had to go through the previous phase.
Right.
Now, sophisticated McLuhan, I'd say that they didn't want to go into immediately the electric environment because that was too much for them, so they went into the older industrial environment. That's like a cyclical retrieval reaction situation, whereas others would say, no, they were just going into the next phase, the industrial, moving out of feudalism into industrialism. Okay, granted, either way, the explosive nature of their situation, moving out in an established center, broad nationalistic center margin structures, which were becoming rapidly obsolete for a big part of the world, the advanced and developed world, they were at that phase, and McLuhan predicted that they would do that, and they did that, and the Dalai Lama probably would not know, if he believed McLuhan, that if they took on the science and industrial development, then the Tibetans would start to want to explode out like the Chinese did. So he may have been interested in technological development, but he wouldn't have been aware of Western knowledge that led to someone like McLuhan seeing the effects of these phases, and that taking on that it would be very hard for his culture to maintain its purity if they did move into the new zone, the new technological adaption. They might have wanted to do it ecologically, bring it in slowly, not upset the culture, but that is very hard to control when you realize that once a new environment is injected into the population, that the effects are pretty uncontrollable in the way it takes it.
Yeah.
So you brought that up, but we were still... I want to go back to your describing their environment. I saw a recent documentary on the history of the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that?
Probably not.
Yeah, it gives the history of Tibet and then the China invasion and what happened after that and the Dalai Lama's response and going to India. But what was interesting, I think it's in that documentary where the Dalai Lama or someone quotes him saying, you and the West went on an outer trip and we went on an inner trip. Or you might have said, you explored and got to the moon and did a much genius in exploring outer space and we explored inner space. Which is a pretty good wrap-up of the dynamic or tension between the two. The thing is that in their inner space exploration, they had images of where they were going for the big picture and images of where they were doing it from. And it doesn't mean that it was right. Or it was beyond their cultural projection.
Mm-hmm.
The Kant explored inner space in the outer space world. So the Kantians would maybe argue with the Dalai Lama, or the Pope would argue with Dalai Lama about how to define the inner space.
Mm-hmm. But you said that LaRouche didn't like Kant. LaRouche liked Kepler. So here's the point I want to make. Kepler saw, he looked at the orbits of the planets and so on within the larger context of the harmony of cosmic music and octaves, and I'm generalizing here. I don't know how he saw it, but in that sense of it being a holistic symphony of harmonies within harmony.
Of external space. I think he was looking at external space under the print impact.
Yeah.
Kant starts to go back into a new post-print inner space, but it's not the same inner space that the Dalai Lama is doing in acoustic culture.
Mm-hmm. But the fact that Kepler intuited this divine harmony and logos and divine law and in the heavens, that it was all operating as one big symphony, and he was looking at and he was getting a holistic view of the cosmos, of the outer nature of the cosmos. That may be what the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan monks were tapping into. They were going inward.
No,
allowing their biology to harmonize with the harmony of the larger whole.
Yeah, but you depends on which word you anchor on. Harmony, you anchor on that, you get something similar. But Kepler was projecting visual space, the telescope space, the sky, whereas the Buddhism was going into what's called inner psychological spaces, into other subtle realms and different energies. It would say that the Venus was in your eye, or that you could go to Venus, whereas Kepler was working out ratios among planets and systems that were hundreds of thousands of miles away and not in the eye, not in the eyeball.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
This gets at this idea of the monad.
When you said no, You were agreeing with me. You were seeing
what
I
am agreeing with you.
Yeah.
This kind of gets maybe a little closer to the idea of the monad or the little me. Because in order to see all the planets as being out there, something separate from you that you can observe,
yeah,
you have to observe from the perspective of the little me, the little human incarnate being looking through a telescope and making calculations and notes
that makes you seem tiny in it, within the immense spaces.
Yeah, but from the Tibetan perspective, if you go in and you see that the outer spheres are within yourself, then you're not separating yourself from that.
Yeah, you're going into a different space.
Mm-hmm.
And the useful.
So there's no little me.
Yeah, it's like you're going into an inner space pre-book effect. Whereas Kant and Kepler are dealing with inner space post-book effect. And the first you have Kepler doing the technically, literally, outer space. And then Kant, when you get into the confusion of the beginning of the Industrial Age and the collapse of the sublimity of the Newtonian Galilean universe, which Pascal confronted, these vast spaces, they began to feel tiny, and it was depressing, especially after the Newtonian vision succumbed to the Darwinian industrial vision, and then early industrial effects started to, you know, dehumanize people's sense of community. So there is the mixture of the environment made by machines mixed in with the environment made by the book, and then you have to juxtapose the Tibetan isolated environment and what they thought they were doing. This is, begins the, you have to deal with figure ground. So it's interesting that LaRouche cites a figure ground guy in trying to talk about this, but definitely LaRouche thinks the solution is not going into subtle regions, whatever they are, you go into pre-literate. He's saying there's a better way to do post-literate awareness, which he calls the creative process with negentropic synthesis. And negentropic meaning not winding down.
Mm-hmm.
And that means getting into thinking in technical ways, but not literally technical ways, and being imaginative and making new inventions. So he, LaRouche, is taking the technology as a given new natural landscape. It's nature for him, and we work within that. Whereas the image of the Buddhists of nature is not the nature of any technological industrial environments. They do have the, from our perspective, the image of nature based on the manuscript. Look at the, in this documentary, it looks so robotic. They'd run by this prayer wheel. They'd have to run by it every day for several times. And then they would flap these little scraps of manuscript and look at them and work obsessively involved with these little pieces of paper. Now, someone could say, well, that was just the external manifestation of them being lost in meditation. But the from the external, it certainly looked pretty pitiful lifestyle. But as McLuhan would say, acoustic people don't have visual reference points. They have totally inner reference points, so it doesn't matter how they look, that they were all wearing the same robe and didn't have much to really work with or eat. They had some basics, survived, but they were almost maybe in states of ecstasy, but that would be the monks. The servants for the monasteries were not in those states, though they might have got sensations from it in their private lives.
Yeah, they may have been happy to serve, to be part of a blissful community and to be of service to that community. Many people who have housekeepers, the housekeepers are just damn happy to be away from the poverty situation they were in and become part of a nice community, a family, which they can serve and become part of that family, an
right.
extension of that family, as long
right.
as it's a nice family. Not
yeah,
all families
so
are nice.
So they're feeling happy in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this thought. So the interesting thing is that the Tibetans go inner, and they've got an interesting semi-slackful civilization, supposedly. But they could not stop the evolution of technology and how it affected their life. So when I say way back there, previous sessions, I think I've said this on the tape, that we're souls that come into this world, and this world is run by technology and media. We engage with it with our soul issues, but it's complicated because of the different issues that the external media and environment, social environments, put on us and among themselves. So what you, when the Dalai Lama says we go inner and you, the West, go outer, it's like they try to move back into soul issues, the soul that reincarnates. That's why they knew about it. Whereas the rest of the world moved into the bufferings of the ongoing hegemonic dominant aspect of this world, second nature, and the evolution of technology, culture, and media. And there, in that second nature world, knocked out the underpinnings of their second nature world, which was heading back to the soul. The question is not to, we still haven't resolved the question whether the soul should come into this world, and media ecology advocates dealing with this world on its terms and not, and letting the soul be a side issue or something that doesn't interfere with the proper statement or grammatical response to the ongoing development of the external second nature world. There's the question raised by China going into Tibet. Tibet's wisdom cannot handle, preserve that culture. But maybe, as William Irwin Thompson says, the Dalai Lama knows that he's a figurehead for a new culture that's not limited to particular cultures. But I don't know if he's resolved the inner and the outer, the soul problem coming into this world, or the fact this world is dominated by second nature technology. That's an issue that's ongoing. Listening to the more recent Dave Emery tapes, Dalai Lama is hanging out with people that have pretty dangerous connections still to terrorist movements and nativist movements around the world. So maybe the Dalai Lama is getting a little confused this far into his life, 2006, compared to what he was thinking 20 years ago. And he's got to deal with this dilemma, too, about what's the relevance. It's not necessarily true that if you just emphasize on soul knowledge, that will create balance in this world, because this world seems to be run by projections, dropping the emissions of human invention. So that's why this sentence, the ego ideal and the inner self, is technological outer space oriented in LaRouche and inner space oriented to the Buddhist, but LaRouche's outer space mandate is different from the standard outer space knowledge paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not going to flip back to he's not going to go inner, but he's going to offer a creative activity for the industrial visual space psyche that is not limited by what he calls the Aristotelian oligarchical frustrated entropic mode.
Yeah, the entropic mode, the Newtonian or the Cartesian mechanical universe, it runs down. It's entropic.
And, yeah, like, so you can... So here's the thing.
What happens if you develop a sense of little I, me, a little monad little me, based on a bunch of labels? You have a name, you have a number, you have a visual space identity underlying, and it's just a language construct, and you think that's what you are. You have no sense of real substance.
And then you do
feel like you're a fake me.
See, that's the soul will always. When people are getting ready to die, they have to give up this world. They have to focus. They have to figure out a new ratio of what's the big picture, and their consciousness in relation to that. And the big picture involves, where am I going after this life? And they may project, as Evering say, whatever the culture's religious figure is, that's who they'll see when they first die. So that's a bigger ratio between, it's a post-second nature, post-technological human world here, ratio doubleness that they've got to develop for the next world. Meanwhile, those are still here. What's unique about LaRouche is that he sees the weakness of the visual space ego. He sees easily how therapies can weaken it. He may not focus on the fact that this is possible even more so in the electric environment, because the number name, as Joyce said, love my label as thyself, the visual space label language is so anemic, not just in relation to the soul issues, but in relation to the new electronic advanced environment of the 20th century. So the issues of whether the soul is more important than this world is... favors the soul when you're getting near death. It's like Campbell used to say, once someone has served in their society in late middle age, they should drop out of society and go back into their soul concerns. Ever heard him talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
But for those younger people and people before their late middle age, they're dealing with second nature and they got to deal with those issues. LaRouche is interesting. He projects a solution for the visual space ego, a mode that's beyond the visual space limitations, but stays within the visual space or in the enterprise of developing technology. He does not move back into soul like the Buddhists do. He will say, and you see it in this, right? He defines the advanced soul as one who understands that he or she must make a contribution to the ongoing evolution of second nature or technology. And that gives them meaning, he says. That doesn't give meaning to Buddhists or to other types of yearnings about what happens after life and where does my soul go. I don't care about this world's kind of attitude. This is temporary. This is Maya. So he stays within the second nature zone. And he comes up with an answer that is does not fall back into the Buddhist emphasis on soul. That is done by the Thompson Quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah. So LaRouche, this is interesting. LaRouche favors Kepler over Newton. Newton and the Cartesian universe is entropic. It's running down. We feel like we're running down. We're growing old. We're dying. We lack energy. We lack vitality and vigor. And LaRouche says, no, there's this fountain of life. If you enter into the creative process that I'm talking about, you'll discover negentropic qualities within you. In other words, you'll generate, rather than constantly depleting your energy through food and sex and entertainment, you'll discover a way to generate energy within yourself, like a dynamo.
An inspiration,
that would be like the fountain, that would be like discovering the fountain of youth.
Yes,
if you could discover within yourself that which is the opposite of everything that's running down, but is actually invigorating, creating, and ramping up, opposed to running down.
You don't look at the image. If you start taking that inner space and exaggerating that, LaRouche, in his anti-Gnostic and anti-mystical things, says don't go too far into getting inner inspirations. Your inspiration is in the external second nature evolution of technology. If you tackle Plato's thinking and all the people after them and all the people today that are developing the correct or advanced form of imaginative technological progress, then you will be talking to Plato, to Kepler. You will be part of the timeless in second nature terms. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And you will be engaging in that dialogue by going back to the original documents and thinking beyond them and applying whatever principles come out of that. When he's laid out a lot of the principles, you will then be able to deal with the energy crisis today, the energy crisis of oil and demanding new kinds of energy and thinking it out and looking at, get into the lab, get into not a corporate controlled lab, a corrupt lab. So he, you see, whereas Thompson would recommend you go off to the mountains of Colorado and meditate and go into the inner and look for inspiration there and then maybe write a poem or two or make a lecture and inspire people that way, you see? And now the thing is what technologies of second nature do you identify with? The technologies of the Tibetan culture was a certain level of food preparation, certain level of farming and agriculture and that. They worked, they didn't totally give that up. Maybe they knew you couldn't. But then you have people identifying with the technologies here, like atomic energy. It's a clash of what level of technologies you're going to engage with, either spread or develop and improve. You see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I heard that, and I want to just go on a slightly different thing that I'm contemplating here about this, where this negentropic energy comes from.
Right.
Like, for instance, if we look at an engine, and the engine's running because it's consuming fuel, when it runs out of fuel, it runs down. So the only place we can get energy from is by transforming substance, some kind of substance which has energy, and then translating that into new energy that we can use, some kind of fuel. Now, we think of, earlier on, he talks about the one substance. And then, like Gurdjieff said, that we need to consume substances, but he says we can learn how to consume these rarefied substances. He even goes so far as to say we consume impressions, and that we translate that or transform that into energy, vitality, life force.
Look at the images and technologies he's talking about. It sounds like he's talking about inner space technologies.
Gurdjieff?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Gurdjieff's more an inner space guy, but I only bring that up because I think LaRouche is saying there's a substance of life, a mana, whatever, the one substance. That can become fuel, and you can become a dynamo if you learn how to run the motors of your mind and your intellect, and your somehow entering into this creative process allows you to consume this more rarefied substance, which translates into energy, and then you become a negentropic expression of creativity.
Okay, but where's the products that he produces? The question is if does one need to have housing and electrical support if you're a yogi and you could live in a cave and be warm through your own self-body generation through your meditative ability? Should everybody do that? That is still a kind of technology. It's an argument over which technological level one needs. And it seems to me that you can't get all the masses to be doing the yogic program.
Yeah, no, I understand that, and I'm not trying to argue. Yeah, I see what LaRouche wants you to do with your creative energy is to find solutions to technological problems.
Yeah, he wants you to become a
Kepler and a Da Vinci.
No, he wants you to realize, he seems to say that when in the land of Caesar, do as Caesar says. And Caesar is ongoing technological evolution.
Mm-hmm.
He is recognizing that this world is run by the technology humans create.
Yeah,
the souls can go to other worlds.
I'm just saying the people who are able to make the creative breakthroughs that LaRouche talks about have incredible energy. That energy has to come from somewhere. I think LaRouche is saying if you enter into the search, the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, or whatever this creative activity is, that you will find this whatever substance you need in order to digest that substance, produce the energy you need to be the creative genius. It takes energy to be a creative genius. That energy has to come from somewhere. And I think that you find it when you enter into this creative process that he talks about. Then you can use, and the creative process he's talking about is the creative process of a science, which is not the category science that we learn in school. It's the science that merges with the artist, or
it's the mystery of the mystery of thinking. Now here's the
creative process that both artists and scientists, because Da Vinci was both an artist and a scientist, the creative process that leads to both.
Yeah,
also,
it's based on sensuous thinking, he says. But let me tell you an interesting thing, since you're emphasizing the word energy. LaRouche has been, over the last couple of years...
And, I want to inject, LaRouche is an economist, so he understands the economy of energy.
Right, and let me tell you, he understands it so much that he has been on a rant and writing essays on the word is not energy. He's really down on the word energy. The word is power. And I think he's aware of the New Agers and the LaRouche, the Thompson Quadrant, talking about energy this, energy medicine, having energy, just all that you laid out. He objects to the use of the word energy, and he has a whole mathematics to say that is not the correct word. So that's something to be aware of when you're talking about it.
Well, I like that, because energy doesn't imply intelligence. It just implies some kind of kinetic activity or motion or whatever. Power, on the other hand, implies volition, will, and energy.
Right, so that's maybe why he's stressing that rather than energy. Now, the thing is, some people, you see, supposedly we Americans got bombed because the technology that's encroaching in the Middle Eastern area, Middle Eastern cultures, they object to the technologies, the McDonaldization of life that we have here. And many people would agree that it is a big disservice. But the McDonald's is just a byproduct of the television world. What technologies are we going to determine are valuable and should be maintained and developed, and those that aren't? That's the argument. And some people say that argument is run by power-hungry people or people too addicted to this world, and we should practice getting out of this world. That's the monastic move, you know, the Christian ideal, not in this world but not of it. It's like they're emphasizing the soul issues are way more important. The compromise to that is, which the Dalai Lama reiterates, is compassion. We're in this confusing situation, and the best way is try to be a nice person. Try to help people that you wouldn't expect to be supported by the society at large. You know, that kind of generosity.
Jesus called it forgiveness, but he was talking about the same thing.
Right.
And, of course, we know it doesn't work to judge, to begrudge yourself or other people. It only entraps you to the degree that you can see that. See, there's this one level of forgiveness where you see that, well, people are like machines. They're doing the best they can. They're caught up in their own cultural memes, and so they do stupid things. And then there's another level of forgiveness, which is implied in some of what Jesus talked about, where the separation never occurred to begin with. It's just a distortion of the ego. Therefore, there's nothing. There is nothing to forgive, and there never was anything to forgive. But I think that elucidates a little more what the Dalai Lama means when he talks about compassion, because compassion is not a weak, puny thing. It's not just altruism. It's more than that. And I just wanted to say that in relation to compassion of the Dalai Lama.
You get a lot of power, and you go off to university, and you invent some new technologies, which then we got to implement and market, and then it upsets lives and enhances other lives. How much do we allow you to express your inspiration in relation to second nature and technology to infringe on other people? And probably, just like the metaphor I begin the Kony ESP with, of the interaction between two people talking, the blocking and the merging, on the larger scale, between cultures, that's the battle today. How much do we block, as the Arabs want to block our culture going there? How much do we merge around the world? That's called globalization. The ongoing drama of just two people talking is mimed on the global level by all the cultures talking to each other and which parts of second nature they emphasize.
Well, if science had evolved out of, if the oligarchs, well, the oligarchs wouldn't have propped up Kepler, or they wouldn't have been oligarchs. But if Kepler's had prevailed, and Tesla had prevailed, and Da Vinci had prevailed, I don't think there would be, then we wouldn't have the fragmentation, which is leading to all the dissonance and the blocking and the cultural hatred between.
Well, no, the blocking and the merging are an ongoing, both are healthy activities.
Yeah, okay. Well, putting that, okay, that I acknowledge that.
Yeah.
I was making a little bit of a bad distinction there. But I'm saying if Kepler and Da Vinci and those kind of minds that LaRouche venerates or honors had won the day and we had lived inside their paradigm, I don't think there would be the fragmentation that we got from the Newton and the Galileo and that line up to the present of scientific thinking.
As LaRouche defines them.
Yeah.
Because other people
may go back as far as choosing Socrates over Aristotle. But
right. But let me just say, Scott, that the professors in these fields would have different terms and maybe mean the same thing. They'd say, no, Newton was a great guy. He did this and that, you know, and they'd argue with LaRouche over who he hoiked up. But you're saying the question that McLuhan raises is, regardless of which individual talent we and model and thinking style we followed, once these new technological environments unfolded, and LaRouche said that the paradigm of Da Vinci would have led to a faster developed world, right? We would have gotten to the 20th century faster. McLuhan says, yeah, but as you develop these environments, they cause unforeseen effects.
Yeah.
And that's the tension here between LaRouche saying get the right people thinking and the best teachers and the new technologies and nobody trying to make huge profits so that other people can't share in them. If you had that less emphasis on capitalistic greed and into some scientific, science-driven economy, a better situation would come faster. But McLuhan said, maybe even those environments, when they came faster, would have unforeseen effects, just as they did eventually when they did arrive. Mm-hmm. That's the question McLuhan's raising. And what favors LaRouche is that nobody's going to pay attention to those questions. The struggle carries on of trying to get better inventions, and the human greed prevents them, which is what's called the oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Human greed is stops, and management, the old oligarchic management, slows down the progress of technology. But then someone would say, well, if they are going to have the effects, McLuhan says, it's good that they're slowed down. At least we can enjoy one era for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, that's what McLuhan used to say. If he had his preferences, he would turn off the media so that we could enjoy the environment we're in at this point, rather than having it upset so quickly. That's definitely Andy LaRouche's view, that the only way we can survive is to make more and more advances in energy and power sources.
Right.
So the images of what we're talking about are determined by different cultures about the environment itself, which is hegemonic or dominant, the technological second nature. It's our relationship in communication with that, aside from the problems of soul.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, that's probably why the industrial age had the separation of church and state. It's like a recognition, well, those are private issues, private psyche issues.
Yeah. Well, and then there's the separation of church and science.
Yes.
You know, the scientists who were making objective measurements realized that the church was full of superstition and they were
here's the power thing.
And they were deluded.
But why did religion come back? It's because, yes, the church was not adequate in relating to this world and second nature technology, but it did answer needs of the soul that entered this zone.
Yeah.
If you don't believe in reincarnation, therefore we're just one life, then the church seems really irrelevant.
Yeah.
But the Dalai Lama throws a loop in this because he brings in pretty good... Well, not everybody would believe it, but a lot of people believe that he proves there is an afterlife. Because
yeah.
They're pretty impressed with the reincarnation of the guru, right?
Right.
Of the Dalai Lama. I mean, the documentary pointed out that the Christians wait for the second coming of the Messiah, whereas the Tibetan Buddhists have the Messiah always there challenging them.
Yeah.
Because the Messiah, the guru, the original avatar is always reincarnated, or
right.
At least his energies.
And then they find the kid, and at 2 years old, he's got all the right answers.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
The possibly, you know, he's speaking in other dialects, and he's obviously the guy they're looking for.
Okay, so he throws... Now, you see the charisma. There's so many problems, as McLuhan laid out in the second nature world of how to organize cultures and technologies, ratios among themselves as we continue on into new extensions of ourselves. You got that confusion, so McLuhan says it drives people to get away from it. And the Dalai Lama gave an escape hatch, or Buddhism did. That's what the counterculture got into. They started to say, yeah, maybe there is more than this life. And so really, though, in my terms, the doubleness problem between the soul issues and the second nature issues of this world, if you go to one side or the other, you get in trouble. And so the counterculture tries to go back to the soul issues. But it's undermined by the fact we're here. So here we have Neo from the Matrix in the interval between the TV body and the chip body at the end of the third Matrix movie. This being in the interval is another way of saying we're double. The human will is in between. And it's that aspect that's important. And LaRouche, in a way, celebrates the in-betweenness of the human will, thought, or personality, whatever it is, the thinking apparatus, the communicating apparatus, it's in the interval, and he never recommends identifying with any formula, especially non-industrial cultures, which stays trapped in a kind of formula like the Buddhist lifestyle of Tibet.
Yeah.
To a Westerner, it looks like a terrible lifestyle. They stay real limited.
Yeah, I understand that. And we kind of covered that a little bit. I want to come back to finish.
Let's redo the quote. I think we can understand the issue.
Yeah, yeah.
And then reread it and look at what he's saying. Because basically he's describing an antidote to the weakness of visual space, the
right.
Little me.
Right.
Which was why I have him in the... He's retrieving acoustic and kinetic non-visual energies and applying them to second nature, not to soul issues, but to second nature technological issues and how you can contribute to that, and claiming that this creative aspect that's not limited to visual space was not created by visual space.
Yeah.
It always was there.
Well, let's read this.
But this is important. Let me finish this thought. It always was there up to due to thinkers or, and see, in a way, he does say technology has an impact. I mean, he talks about this certain kind of written language that comes out of the Sanskrit that was very important for enhancing conception ability, and that influenced the West. And then Plato and Socrates, they developed stuff coming out of Pythagoras and Moses and the Egyptians. He's saying there's a certain almost formulaic way to do it, but it's not embedded in any ritual or knowable form. It just says, do not interrupt with the way people can tap into that. Do not prevent them from reading the original texts, the original greats, and replaying those thought forms and those discoveries.
Right.
You know, that's formulaic.
That's one thing I know that he insists that his students go back and read the original documents and replicate the original experiments.
Yeah.
So they can experience for themselves, whereas, you know how a guy has something and it's true, and he says it to one guy, the next guy distorts it a little, says it to the next guy, the next guy distorts it a little, says it to the next guy. Well, by the time we hear the story in school, it's generations away from the original thinker and the original experiment, and we're trying to, it's just...
Right, so you go back to the original text. Now, how's our time on this side? The time is working?
Just a few minutes.
Okay, so we'll end on this. Maybe we'll read the quote on the next side.
Okay.
But let's continue here.
We didn't, when I was in school, we didn't drop an apple off the top of the building and measure the how long it took. No, they tried to give me some kind of formula that would, explain how it all works. But we didn't actually go out and make the observation.
That's because you were in a society where consumption was the primary means of keeping the cash flow going, and you guys were going to be consumers, and you didn't need to know this stuff. You actually didn't need to do inventions, hardware inventions. You were going to be part of the software consumption,
mm-hmm.
which really, caused a problem for Lucius' paradigm, hopes, and plans. Just, he's been totally marginalized. He can't get to the mainstream, even though the anti-IMF protests of 99, 2000, before September 11th, they were all talking about issues that LaRouche wrote on and expertly for 25 more years. And yet they wouldn't bring him in because he didn't have a conversational or image style to communicate through the TV medium. So he was marginalized, still is, and that shows the weakness of the power that he claims to represent.
Well, plus he was attacked by the managers.
Media. Yeah, by the TV body's iconography.
Yeah,
and
he was slandered in such a way. And you can today's media environment, if they want to make you look stupid or even criminal, they can build a fake profile, put it out over the media, and everybody's going to believe it because people believe what they see and what they read.
Yeah, the mixture of oral and visual space that is the West is what LaRouche represents. He's not interested in the tactility in the interval, even though he does advocate a kind of conceptual intervalness, but he doesn't see how the intervalness of the electronic environment frustrates his conceptual program. The you could do it. You see, could you turn off television or radio and then slow down the side and get back to the thinking that LaRouche thinks would move us into emphasizing energy devices, power devices, not entertainment information devices, but ways of solving the energy crisis?
Well, everybody, and it doesn't take conspiracy theorists to tell you this today, will tell you, oh, the big oil conglomerates are so invested, the whole economy runs around fossil fuels, and nobody's going to let these guys come through with their inventions anyway.
Right.
The man on the street will tell you that. It doesn't take a conspiracy theorist.
Right. So we see the weakness of LaRouche's program here. An interesting thing is that when we're talking about the soul and the second nature world, they're not separate. They're so intertwined that we call it someone's ego. So that these oligarchs hijack the technological world, and it may be due to soul problems. Are we near the end?
We got a little bit more, but not much.
Okay, so when people, it's really interesting how the soul, where we make these divisions, the world of the soul and the world of second nature, but there's no separation between them, and that creates the confusion. I mean, Hitler, becomes the first pop star in Germany, electrified radio pop star, and as a result, his band wreaks havoc on the music industry all around the world, right? The jazz world, they came up in the 20s, and I'm using those terms metaphorically. You know, he created a huge racket that led to the big noise of the atomic bomb. The soul and the technology are so intertwined, that's what's interesting. Now, is this guy just had a bad reincarnation?
Right.
In terms of
the intertwining of the soul and the technology, I remember a few years back, I went to visit this group who does all the they use the white noise on the tape recorder to